I'm going to present here is sort of a concept primarily, but I will show a few examples of where genomics can have some potential impact in basically what I'm calling one big happy family here. And I'm focusing on the Anthropogonia C4 grasses specifically. And so I have some of them pictured here. Maize, saccharum or sugarcane, sorghum, and then miscanthus. And then I have switchgrass here also, though I won't really be speaking about anything specifically there. I just put them here as for comparators. And so what I want to sort of convey here, that the main point, and I'll just say it up front, is that we're thinking about modifying these plants and using them in a different way. And so that means we have an opportunity to make changes that are more suitable for this particular application, that being biofuels. And we have the advantage now where we sort of have a lot of genomics resources that could be applied to this. And so that should hopefully accelerate that development. I know this point has been made already a couple of times in other presentations I've heard at the meeting, but I'll show you a couple examples of where I think we can make an impact. So as Martin already alluded to, I'm involved in a number of different arenas in institutions, both on campus and then through collaborations. So I just want to put those up here at the beginning. And at first, all of the work that I'm going to talk about, it originates from the University of Illinois, and mostly through my collaboration with Fred Bilo. And this is work that we have been doing for a number of years in looking at the corn response to nitrogen. And so there's some interesting things that we've been learning about, because as we've been measuring nitrogen response, we're measuring biomass. And so even though we didn't get into this initially from 4 or 5 years ago from the biofuels perspective, with the recent attention on biomass, we can look at the data in a little bit different way. And then also, as Martin mentioned, the Institute for Genomic Biology and what's called the MBBC theme, and that's with Hans Blaschek. And we've worked with him and Fred Bilo on one particular project I'll tell you about. And that's also been publicized recently through the Center for Advanced Bioenergy Research on the Illinois campus. And then also Steve Long. So Steve Long is sort of viewed as a leader in the miscanthus arena. And early on, when I got to Illinois, he wanted to do some molecular work with miscanthus. And at the time, no one had cloned a gene. There was no information about the molecular biology of this organism. And so that's how I got started in this, and now it's become a much bigger deal now with the BP thing, which is the next institute I'll tell about. I will touch a little bit on what we're planning to do in this joint venture, essentially between BP, the University of California at Berkeley, and the University of Illinois. And specifically, I'll talk about the feedstock genomics project, which involves Dan Roxar at the University of California, Berkeley, and the Joint Genome Institute, and Ray Ming and Matt Hudson, colleagues at the University of Illinois. And then this just shows some of the other, how I got into some of this work in another way, and that's through our Nitrogenes project that's funded by the NSF through the Plant Genome Research Program. And also some of what I'll show came from a study we did with BASF and Brent Godchalk at BASF early on when we were evaluating and screening a large number of lines for nitrogen response. Okay, so sort of the backdrop. Where are we? What's the sort of the challenge or the goal here? And so this comes from the DOE GTL Center Genomes to Life report, or roadmap as it was called. And within there's this what's called the 30 by 30 vision, where 30% of our transportation fuels will be renewable biofuels, and this will occur by 2030. So this is an optimistic view, but to achieve this, then really the key thing is there is a need for 1.4 billion tons of biomass annually, and of that, about 1 billion tons are projected to come from agricultural sources. So that's a real challenge, because we have to do this also in a sustainable and carbon positive manner. Carbon neutral is sort of the minimum, and carbon positive is sort of preferred here. Okay, so where is this going to come from? This again is from the same roadmap, the DOE roadmap, but here lists some of the sources, and you can see corn stover is the biggest source. And if you total all these up, it's about 200 million dry ton per year. And where we need to go, again, is 1 billion tons, so that's a fivefold increase. And this is where they project. This is PERLAC's report, a DOE-USDA joint report. And the relative contributions of these same feedstocks are pretty similar, except for corn, stover, and perennial crops, perennial grasses, being the major contributors, each about a third, and then the rest of these about another third. And added in here, compared to here, are things like soybeans and like CRP residues that weren't in this one. So the point being, about two-thirds of this biomass increase is projected to come from C4 grasses, maize, and then perennial grasses. And these are some of the assumptions in how we would get from here of 75 million tons of stover to here. And so 25 to 50% yield increases over a 25-year period, a harvest index of 0.5, which is where we are now, and then removing 75% of that stover. So you can quibble with the assumptions and such here, but those are where you know these numbers come from. And then for perennial crops, it's expected that 35 to 55 million acres would be used, and with this kind of yield. So these are realistic. They're not total. They're not outrageous assumptions, but they're challenging nevertheless. Okay, so in addition to increasing yield, we need to modify quality. And so for any of you who've been in plant improvement for a while, when you hear those two words together, we've got a yield, improved yield and quality, usually run for cover because it's a challenge. We all know this. But this just shows the process from a feedstock to a biofuel, whether it be butanol or ethanol. And so there's a pretreatment, which softens the cell walls, and then a hydrolysis deconstruction. Usually these are performed by some kind of cellulase enzyme, and then microbial fermentation. Okay, and it's very difficult to actually compare sort of ethanol yields and production costs and these kind of things, but I at least found two reports that by the same author actually, and this is in the USDA OENOEPNU, where this was looking at sort of the feasibility of sugar as a source for ethanol. But from there, they evaluate or compare a number of different feedstocks. And I just show some of their numbers here just to give perspective where the real point I want to make is in the processing end, where you have starches, and there are sort of costs associated with the two major ways that's done now. Sugars, which are done in Brazil. And I use the Brazil here because their cost of production, they've been doing it a lot longer. There's actually numbers for the U.S. sugarcane industry as well. And then also molasses, and this could be either from sweet sorghum or from sugarcane as well, either one of those. But the point here is as you get to simpler sugars, the cost of processing goes down. And so I want to make that point here because it'll become important when I mention a few things later. Okay, so again, the DOE challenge to agriculture is this 30 by 30 vision, and we need to increase yields 5 to 10-fold. Of biomass. We need to modify the cell wall composition to optimize degradation and conversion, and we need to do this in a carbon positive manner. So again, this red here at the bottom, this is usually very difficult, very challenging thing. So that's where you know potentially genomics could help us in new ways to approach this. Okay, so I'm going to focus specifically on C4 grasses and why this is the case. I've kind of alluded to it already, but I just show here some numbers that come from a variety of sources, and people could argue with them, but I try to be broad in the range here. But just to give perspective, and that perspective is that this group down here are clearly head and shoulders above most of the other types of feedstocks that, in terms of biomass yield, that you would use. And so all of these are C4 grasses, and there are a variety of physiological reasons why they're so productive. And I have here's my picture taken next to switchgrass and then miscanthus on the right, side-by-side plots on the University of Illinois campus. And when you see this, and you see it in April, and you see it all the way through the season, you know, you really start to think, you know, miscanthus is sort of, if it can work, and there's a lot of other things that have to happen for that to be achieved, but the potential, the yield potential is certainly there. And so if we're going to focus on improving yield, it'd be best to start with the things that are the highest yielding at the beginning. Okay, in addition, as I said, there's one big happy family here. When you look at these, this is a taxonomic, actually a phylogenetic tree here, and miscanthus and sugarcane are very closely related. In fact, there have been reports of intergeneric hybrids between these two. And then sorghum is in this group, and then zea maize, and then I have sort of the outgroup here is rice, which would be actually really almost off the chart here in terms of relationship to the others. But the point I want to make is these are very closely related to each other in terms of their genome, their structure, and the genes that they share. And then also, but yet, despite that close relationship phylogenetically, there's a wide range of adaptation in these species. You've got some tropical types, you have temperate adapted. Perennials and annuals, some of these are very much more stress tolerant than others. And so these are, you can kind of look at this as one system and sort of taking a base genome and using it in a little bit different way, evolutionarily, as they've evolved into specific niches. There's also a versatility of carbon form. And so this alludes back to the processing costs that I was mentioning before. You have starches with maize grain, simple sugars in the case of sugarcane, and then lignocellulosic for all of them. And we know of ways to sort of interconvert those carbon forms to one another. For example, in maize, there's the sweet corn that reduces starch and increases sugar. So we know a lot about these things. We need to learn more, obviously, but the point I want to make is they're closely related, but yet they are quite versatile and particularly well-suited for the biofuels arena. Okay, so remember this DOE challenge to agriculture, fivefold increases in yield. And we've already done this for one of these grasses, and that's maize. And so here I just show, this graph has been showed, I think, a number of variety of forms here at this meeting. But to achieve that, there have been a number of ways to do it over a 75-year period. And so agronomy, definitely part of it. We've optimized heterosis, and that's where you get this, you know, the real big jump from the 30s on. Improved stress tolerance. And then more recently, biotechnology and genomics. And if you've heard some, I know Monsanto's given a couple of presentations here where they've sort of monitored or quantified that impact of those two, and they project out what the impact of these two will be, and it will be significant. They project 300 bushel corn is certainly within the realm of possibility if we keep on our current track. So the point is, we have done this, but to do it again, I don't think we want to wait 75 years. We won't achieve the 30 by 30 goal. In fact, we have to do it in about a third of the amount of time to get there. Okay, so this was actually a figure we prepared for a proposal to the DOE GTL program. We didn't get funded through that, unfortunately, but it's a good way to sort of put together the different aspects to this. And so you have traits that you want to change. You need to have germplasm and genetics that have the variability to make those changes. Having genome sequences and the associated functional information. And then eventually biotechnology. All these are part of a pipeline where we're trying to understand the system, and then we can modify that system. And so where genomics has a role is identifying genes and optimizing the genetic diversity or the variation that we would use, and then accelerating the desirable responses to selection, whether that be through biotechnology or conventional breeding. And so what we can do is target the functional variation instead of sort of just the phenotypic component. And so where the opportunity is here is why I use genomics-assisted sort of as the perspective here, is for something like switchgrass and miscanthus, where there hasn't been a lot of work done in the past, we have the opportunity to use all of these new tools. So whereas in maize, in the 1930s, we had to go with simple phenotypic selection, and it took a while to achieve that, where with genomics, hopefully we can accelerate that time frame. Okay, so I'll give you a few examples, three, and one of them I'll talk about is corn stover biomass. And I will show this graph, which I took from data that came out of our nitrogen response trials that we were doing in collaboration with Fred Bielow. And all this was done on Fred Bielow's nitrogen responsive field site, where he's managed the fertility for more than 15 years. It's hard to find a field in the Midwest where nitrogen is not at high levels. So what we did here is we used a set of genotypes that are called the diversity lines. For those who are in maize, they've probably heard of these. They are used, they're sort of the core group for association genetic mapping. And they were chosen to represent the maximum genetic diversity within maize germplasm, as judged by molecular marker data, and some pedigree information as well. So all of these lines were crossed to B73. And then they were evaluated over a two-year period in replicated trials. And we measured a lot of different traits here, but I'm just showing biomass above ground. And here, this bottom line here, this is at the V8 growth stage, so plant about this big. And then at the R1 growth stage, or anthesis, and then at physiological maturity. That's just stover biomass there. And the point I want to make here is you see very little response to N. Okay, those lines are essentially flat, and statistically there is no response. Okay, then grain yield, obviously here, this is grain yield, there is a response. And so in maize, most of the response to nitrogen is in the grain. So if you're thinking about biomass, you know, then you don't need to have grain. Maybe you could just do stover, and you know, but the point is then you don't need nitrogen if that's your goal. Okay? And one question was, well, this is a diverse set of material. Maybe it's representative of maize, but it may not be representative of commercial elite germplasm. And so Fred Bielow, in a lot of other different projects, has evaluated a number of commercial hybrids in the same manner. And a summary of that data is here, where grain yields are obviously much higher, 7 metric ton. These are all numbers at low nitrogen. So this subscript here of 0 means low nitrogen. Stover biomass is about the same, so it's of a harvest index of about 0.5. The response to nitrogen in the grain is high, as we know, but the stover response is very limited. And we see this same trend then in a group of other germplasm sources. So this was the group here that we evaluated with BASF a few years ago, a large, wide range of maize. We had a smaller group that were tropical Brazil-derived lines intergressed into temperate-adapted, and so they show actually the biggest biomass response, and I think that's because of the tropical germplasm, and I'll get to that here in a minute as well. And then we also used what is the sort of the standard, the best high-resolution mapping population in maize, the IBM, or intermated B73 Missouri 17 material, cross that to Illinois high protein, which is the product of the century-long term selection for grain nitrogen. And we use this, again, because of our nitrogen project. We were trying to discover genes for nitrogen use efficiency, but we can still look at some of the other things we saw in there, which was the stover and the lack of response to nitrogen. So those are the main points here. And obviously to do these kind of measurements, you need a large group of people. And so these are a group of us after, I think, what Fred calls his record sampling day, 750-some plots in one day. And then this is actually some of the IBM hybrids here, and a group with pollinating and doing the sampling. So big effort. And out of this then, we have, because the genetic map exists already for the IBM lines, we can map QTL for stover biomass and grain yield. And so the green ones here are stover biomass. There are some QTL that are present at low N or high N. They differ. And this is only 1 year of data, and Devin Nichols has this on his poster. That's at 4 to 6 tonight or later on, so you can ask more about the details there. But we can map our QTL, so this would be useful if we want to increase the stover biomass. Okay, another story I'm going to tell you is what I'm going to call sugar corn. And here's Fred Bielow. He's actually in the audience, but he's here on screen too, holding a plant, a hybrid, that was derived from a cross of a tropical line to a temperate line. And then Mike Vincent, the graduate student who's then been looking at this material for its biomass and carbon producing potential. So here just shows pictures of what these hybrids look like. This is the earliest and shortest of the group. These are the diversity lines again across the B73, and it flowers pretty early. Here then is actually in the middle of these three here is B73 Missouri 17, a very standard maize hybrid. And then here on the left are the later flowering tropical-derived hybrids, where one of the parents is from a tropical-derived inbred line. So it, when you move it to Illinois, it has delayed photoperiod or photoperiod sensitivity that delays flowering, and you get more biomass. And then you also have an asynchrony between the pollen and the ear. And so that's shown here in this particular column, where the days to the interval between enthesis and silking is greater. And so what happens is you get less seed on these ears. And from a grain yield perspective, that's terrible. That's not desirable. But from a stover biomass perspective, interestingly, there's no real change in total biomass. So essentially what you're doing is taking a maize plant and converting it into a stover crop instead of a grain crop. And grain yield is way down here, and the number of kernels is way down. So then the question is, well, if you don't have an ear and this plant's bigger and it's a C4 photosynthetic factory, where's that carbon going? And this just shows a cross-section of a stem harvested in September 12th, I think, actually. And then what we did is we squeezed the juice out of these stems, these stalks. and then measured the we also measured the biomass at that time, and then we measured the sugar content in those in that juice. And what we find, basically in these tropical groups, is you have a lot of stover biomass and you have a lot of sugar, a high percentage of sugar in that that stock juice. And then if you calculate out the sugar yield on a per acre or per area basis, it's equivalent to, or so maybe even greater than, say, U.S. sugarcane production in this state or Texas or you know, the southern area here. And so here I just show again these hybrids, but we also see this in another, you don't have to have a tropical variety to do this. So we also see this. This is actually a genotype that I'd reported on a few years ago where we made a transgenic line that delays flowering. It overexpresses a transcription factor. And that single gene, here's the hybrid without the gene and then with the transgene. So you see it's a delayed flowering, much bigger plant. And so the question was, what does the sugar look like in that? And we see, again, there's a high percentage of sugar in that stalk that we squeeze out. And so this was actually pretty interesting because it sort of raised the question of whether maize could actually be a temperate sugar cane. And you know, these are just some of the other numbers then that come with that, that the yields of this sugar are comparable, again, to either sugar cane or sugar beets, and that it's simple sugars that are produced. And we've already also, this is Hans Blaschik's lab, has shown that that stalk sap can be used directly by fermentative bacteria to produce butanol. So there's a potential here to have a crop that would be a sugar source in a temperate environment, something that farmers know how to do in Illinois especially very well. And so we're quite excited about this and interested in what the possibilities might be. Okay, the last story I'll tell you about real quickly is the work that we're just getting started with the Energy Biosciences Institute. And again, the goal here is to build genomics resources for miscanthus and saccharum improvement. And so again, here's our big happy family, and we view these as sort of a system of species or genera. And this is sort of our current status of where for ESTs, for genome sequence information, for RNA expression profiling, and high density molecular markers, both the markers and the genetic populations that would be going with those. And so we see for like maize and rice, they're all available, okay, and so that's great. Maize is the first of this group that has, well, next year we'll have the genome completed. Sorghum is pretty good also, and I think there'll be more effort there. I know some of the recent funding will hopefully fill in this gap here, and definitely this gap. But then in saccharum, there is a large EST collection. The Brazilians have done this, and they have a small array that can be used. JGI is contemplating sequencing the saccharum genome, and so I don't know for sure if that'll happen, but I think it will go forward. And then miscanthus is sort of the poor boy here in the group, in that I could count 10 ESTs, and by ESTs they're really cDNA sequences, most of which came from my lab. We have nothing, we don't know anything about the genome, we don't have an RNA profiling system, and we definitely don't have any markers. So it's to fill in these gaps, and especially miscanthus is one of the primary goals of the EBI project. Again, just going back to these graphs, I'll show you just a couple things of what we're planning to do, and that in the sequencing, and this will be led by Dan Roxar at JGI, and we're going to definitely do a miscanthus EST project. We'll get a lot of tissues and hopefully 500,000 or so at least, and we'll use the newer sequencing technologies to speed this up. But we're also going to try, we're going to attempt to do a draft genome sequencing of miscanthus and saccharum. As I said, saccharum probably will happen. Miscanthus, it depends on where the funding comes from. But the idea here is, because these grasses are so closely related to sorghum, that we can use sorghum as a template to assemble the short reads that would come out of the new sequencing technology. So here shows rice compared to sorghum, and it's about 85% similar in the genic regions. Maize is in the 90s, and then saccharum is 95 to 100%. So, and remember how close miscanthus and saccharum are to each other. And so we think that miscanthus will be very similar to the saccharum. So the goal here is to do high throughput sequencing and then use the sorghum genome as a scaffold to assemble. We also will look at genetic diversity. And there we're going to do targeted resequencing of genes that we would associate with either yield or biomass quality. And then this will be done in collaboration with the a number of groups that are assembling germplasm collections, Mendel Biotechnology. There's a Hawaiian Agricultural Research Center that has had a sugarcane program for a while, and they've actually got a sugarcane by Miscanthus population that we'll use for interspecific or intergeneric mapping. The last thing I'll say is, what would you do with this information then? And I'll just do show you two things that you can do. And one of them is sort of, if you look back at maize breeding and the optimization of heterosis, this is sort of what happened, in that the genetic diversity sort of pre-heterotic pools was quite extensive. But then to optimize heterosis, there was a reciprocal recurrent selection that drove this allelic variation into two groups, but diversity was maintained within each group. And so that then crossing between these two groups is what allows you to get a strong heterotic response. And obviously, heterosis is the first step to increasing the biomass. I mean, one thing about Miscanthus giganteus, the particular clone that has had a lot of attention, it is a triploid, and it probably exhibits already hybrid vigor because of that. But we need to optimize that, especially if we're going to go to more of the diploid and simpler genomes for Miscanthus. So the idea is there, if we have marker information up front, then we could potentially design the heterotic pools to maximize or optimize heterosis and also maintain a desirable population structure to enable continued progress over time. And then the last thing is, with obviously functional genomics, if you have an array, you can compare types for a variety of traits. Fertility is an issue with these perennial grasses, self-compatibility. The form of carbon storage, is it cellulose, is it starch, is it sugar? Pathogen resistance will be a big deal for all of these crops because none of them have been grown on a wide scale, especially Miscanthus. And then stress tolerance and a variety of other physiological processes that are sort of really would increase either quality or the yield potential. So that's where we're at. We're just getting started, and I guess the only plug I'll make is we'll be hiring both faculty, postdocs, students in this area over the next year. So if there's anyone in the audience or there's anyone at your institutions that's interested in this arena, there'll be an active phase of staffing the Energy Biosciences Institute over the next year. So I may look forward to hearing from any interested applicants on that. So with that, I think I'll take any questions you may have. Yeah, so the question was in the sugar sap from the maize, what's the ratio of sucrose, glucose, fructose? I know that it was measured, and I think it's about 50% sucrose and about half, and so 25 of the others. But I think it varies depending on when you sample that, because we've sampled it numerous times. So the one I showed you there is like about 50, 25, 25, but it does change over time. Marilyn. Yeah.
Okay, so you mentioned using markers to try and drive your heterotic groups apart. There's lots of evidence that once they're apart, the markers will register them. But is there any evidence that the markers can be used to push them apart and then you'll still see the heterosis? It will be different, but will be what you need.
I don't know if there's not. I mean, you can only look retrospectively and say, this is what's happened. And I think there's information out there, especially from Monsanto and Pioneer, about using haplotype information to sort of assemble or predict performance. I don't think it's precise, but we're in the early stages of that too. So, but if you have the information, you can actually address that question experimentally. And if you don't have the information, then you can't. So, but yeah, very good point. Okay, so the question is, what saccharum species will be sequenced? No, that's not been decided. I think there's a lot of discussions. I know Ray Ming was meeting with the sugarcane biotechnology group. There's some meeting. I don't remember the exact name of the organization, but there is a group. There's also a Brazilian group that we've spoke to about this because they've done the EST sequencing. So it's not been decided. If there are, from the community, if there are particular varieties or types to nominate, we'd be happy to hear about them. Owen.
For the sugar corn trial, was that under low end conditions or standard
Yeah, so Owen asked about whether the sugar corn trial was under low N or regular sort of nitrogen input. It was low N. All those numbers I showed were low nitrogen. And the biomass doesn't increase with nitrogen. And in fact, the high nitrogen trials that we did in parallel with those in side-by-side plots, the sugar level actually goes down with nitrogen. So from a sugar corn perspective, you wouldn't need very much nitrogen fertilizer. So this whole idea of corn's a terrible biofuels crop because it needs too much nitrogen goes out the window if you do this strategy. If you need grain, yes, definitely you need nitrogen.
So the cost of production would be quite a bit low.
Yes. Yeah, we believe so.
Yes, one last question.
I've also squeezed out the same founders, and I didn't find sugar had levels nearly that high in Ithaca. Could you explain maybe how you calculated the yields per hectare and what production system you would see? I mean, if there's going to be facilities built for sugar in northern latitudes?
So the question is sort of, taking this sugar and then what's the next steps? And there are a lot of things that could be done. We haven't decided on any of these, and we're thinking about it. But in terms of the sugar yields and compared to where you are, the photoperiod thing obviously has a big impact. But the fact that this transgenic also does it makes us think it's not sort of related to tropical material specifically. The way that we squeezed it, there aren't available presses for this like commercially, so we kind of designed a homemade press, pressed it in the field, collected it. It was about 125 mils per plant, and then that was directly used in the Brix measurements that were made, and then the HPLC analysis was done to measure the form of sugar.
Okay, the last question over there.
Yeah, competition between sugar corn and regular corn. Obviously, there will be, yes. But I think the sugar corn idea, it has maybe the potential to be grown on a little more marginal land. I mean, we did it in Illinois, so there's not much marginal land in Illinois. You're talking about corn production. So, so whether this would, do this on another, and again, I showed a slide where, depending on where you are, different feedstocks will have advantages and disadvantages. In Illinois, whether it would compete, it depends on who would take that sugar and what they'll pay for it. And we have ADM sitting in the middle of the state, and they'd use a lot of sugar. So they may be interested in it. And then the process, you had asked earlier, someone contract a service to come in, press it, tank it, and take it to where it needs to go. That could be one issue. But how much that costs and is it profitable? We haven't really investigated that yet.
Thank you very much, Steve.
Sure.